You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. This is your host, Paul Massey, Director of Regeneration's Botanical Garden. And on today's show, we'll grow in our appreciation of the wild food plants from the fields and forests of Hawaii and delve into the promising paradigm of biochar as soil fertility enhancer and climate change solution. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is brought to you by listeners like you in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda Garden and Lawn Equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
The Kauai store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kasiles. The store has authentic Kauai products, including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
And thank you so much to our generous underwriters and to each and every one of you who keeps us on air. We want to give a mahalo to everybody who lends their support, the volunteers, the board members, and the donors, of which we all try to be. Please make your tax-free donation today by visiting kkcr.org. You can click the donate button at the top of the page. Or you can call our office line at 826-7774 or toll free 866-275-1112. This is your host, Paul, and I'm here for the hour, excited for a couple of great guests we have coming in via phone. And they're going to be providing learning opportunities here on Kauai coming up this weekend. So we'll get to that, but we'll start off with our celestial session as we look to the heavenly skies above for inspiration and guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other gardening and farming activities this week. And we'll start with the Hawaiian moon, today's Hawaiian moon phase, brought to us by the 2015 Western Pacific Fishery Management Council calendar, available online with a simple internet search. And today's Hawaiian moon is Ole Ku Kahi. Ole Ku Kahi will rise over Kauai today at 12:40 p.m. She'll reach her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 6:34, and she'll set at 12:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. And 50% of the moon's beautiful face will be illuminated, making today the first quarter moon. So we're in the waxing period of the moon. And this is traditionally a time of rest for planters. It's the first of four Ole moons, so it begins that rest period. Because it is considered unlucky for fishing, planting, or beginning any important activity, because Ole also means nothing. That's not why, but that is an explanation of how it got its name. And, of course, these observations based on countless generations of Mahi'ai, the planters of Hawaii, noticing the influence of the moon and ordering their activities based on those influences. We want to thank Heaven on Earth Starts for our biodynamic look at things today, where we'll look at the whole week of influences of the heavenly bodies. Starting today, Wednesday, the 18th of November, the moon is in the constellation of Capricorn, which is an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our rooting plants. We're actually not in the transplant phase right now. And so then tomorrow, Thursday, the moon moves into Aquarius and stays there on Friday. This is an air sign, making it a good time to work with flowering plants. And specifically because we're in that ascending moon period, it's a good time to make cuttings, grafting, and vegetative propagation. And I want to thank our buddy Teddy, who is donating some special jackfruit, champadec, and champajack varieties of scion wood, and also the skill to graft them onto some of our jackfruit trees at the food forest. So we're hoping very much for some good influence there from the heavenly bodies in that work. A bit difficult to do that work on the members of the breadfruit, jackfruit family, Moraceae, because of that really strong latex sap that comes out. So we need all the help we can get. So Saturday through Monday, the moon will be in the constellation of Pisces, a water sign. This is a good time to work with leafing plants. And again, pruning and weeding would be good activities, not planting so much. And then Tuesday, the moon goes into the fire sign of Aries, making it a good time to work with our fruiting plants. So there's your biodynamic look at things for today. And I'm going to stick in a visit to the medicine chest before we get to our first guest on the show. And we're looking at a beautiful plant that I had the fortune to experience up close and personal on my trip to Molokai a few weeks ago, more than a month ago now. And this is the clove plant, a plant that we're all very familiar with from the spice rack, but maybe not so much from the living plant that grows well here in Hawaii. Syzygium aromaticum is the botanical name. It's in Myrtaceae, or the myrtle family, along with Ohia lehua, guava, java plum, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the program. It's also it's in the same genus as java plum and rose apple, which are two cherished naturalized species in Hawaii. And let's see, you can see also Syzygium sandwichensis, Ohia ha. This is a native plant unique to the Hawaiian Islands in the same genus as clove. You can see it easily in Koke'e, for example, at the Kalalau Lookout and surrounding areas. These clove trees are, however, not native to Hawaii. They're endemic to the Maluku Islands in Indonesia, along with nutmeg and mace, are also which come from the same plant, the nutmeg tree. And because of their source, this is how these Maluku Islands gained their nickname, the Spice Islands. Also native to, it's also the native home of the Moluccan albizia, our maligned but beloved albizia tree native here in Hawaii, or rather naturalized here in Hawaii. There were spice wars between the Europeans, various European factions which displaced or killed large numbers of the native Indonesian people of those islands, sadly, hundreds of years ago. The spice consists of the dried flower buds, not the fruit. This was a surprise to me. This is a great example of knowing what and when to harvest. So it's actually the fruit that I was able to collect was not what you make the spice from, but you sure can smell that beautiful clove scent in the fruit as well. These seeds are recalcitrant. They need to be sowed straight away, and we do have some beautiful young plants coming up in the nursery I'm excited about. As far as the medicinal qualities, it's used in Ayurvedic and Chinese herbal therapy as well as Western herbal medicine. It's a really good antidote for pain in toothache. It aids digestion by stimulating the production of hydrochloric acid in the stomach and improves peristalsis, the movement of food through the digestive system. Clove expels parasitic worms when taken internally. and can be used cautiously in colon hydrotherapy for this purpose. Used topically to warm the body and aid digestion. It can be used as an ant repellent as well. And back to the cultivation of clove, reportedly takes anywhere, depending on what internet website you read, 4 to 20 years to flower. So this is one to get started with soon, and like many plants, perhaps what we'll do is grow seedlings up to the point where we can graft more mature material from an older tree to get enhanced production. But I was surprised to see that cultivation by seed is the general way in which it is grown. I suppose in those regions of the world, they already have mature clove trees, so they're not really in a hurry for the next generation to come along. But because of this long period, it's probably why it's not considered to be an invasive risk in Hawaii, although there are other many invasive members of the family, of course, strawberry guava, that sort of thing like that. So loving the clove, and delicious, nutritious, and hopefully we'll see more of these plants around. I've not seen one on Kauai. I'm sure they're here, but definitely deserves more cultivation, a beautiful tree, very ornamental fruits on this tree. And that's your medicine chest report for today. This is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. And right now, we're going to be joined by our first guest. This is Sunny Savage is calling us over from Lahaina on Maui. Sunny grew up in the Smoky Hills State Forest in north central Minnesota. After earning a master's degree in nutrition education with a focus on antioxidants of wild greens, she's taught native nutrition, founded a clothing company in partnership with tribal villagers from, I think, Nepal. We'll have to ask her that. Starred in her own television series and now is the author of a new book, Wild Food Plants of Hawaii. She'll be on Kauai over the next several days, offering wild food hikes and opportunities to get your own copy of the book and meet her in person. Sunny, are you with us?
I am here. Thank you, Paul.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to say welcome to Kauai soon, although you're calling us from the beautiful Bay of Lahaina.
I am.
Why don't you paint that picture for our listeners?
Well, I lived for 3 years on a boat with my husband and my oldest son, and we just found ourselves a fantastic deal on a sweet little 25-foot boat, and we just spent our first evening, and so we're sitting on the boat, and it's absolutely fantastic over here.
Wow. Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, it sounds nothing better right now, but it's funny because you are such a person of the soil.
Right.
And the earth, and yet here you are suspended over the ocean. But I'm excited that you're going to be setting your feet here on Kauai and bringing your knowledge and your perspective on wild foods.
Yeah, I'm really excited to get over there, and I've got a great lineup of events kind of spread out around the island. So hopefully that'll give folks in different areas a chance to connect if they're interested in learning more about wild foods.
Yes, please. Let's get those out early on.
Yeah. Well, I've got this coming Friday, November 20th, from 1 to 3 o'clock at Lydgate State Park, and we're going to be meeting by the playground kind of in the northerly part of the state, the park. And we're just going to use the time to kind of walk around and identify some plants, kind of take a moment to talk story about the ethics of wildcrafting and pointers and, you know, kind of tips that I've learned through the years of foraging. And then I'll be at Talk Story in Hanapepe for their event. I think it's like an art walk in town there. And I'll be there from 5 to 9 p.m. Signing books right there at the store. And then the next day, Saturday, it'll be a busy day from 9 to noon. I'll be at the Aninaho Farmers, again, signing books. I've got a workshop in the afternoon where we'll be going out and identifying plants, be harvesting them, and then we'll actually be using our own hands to process and prepare them into a small, kind little feast. And then on Monday, the 23rd, a wild food hike up
in Kauai State Park from 2 to 4 p.m. We'll be meeting at the cabins area.
Yeah, fantastic. Wow.
Well, yeah.
It's such a beautiful thought that even though you haven't scouted out these places, that mm-hmm. you know that your wild food friends are going to be waiting for you.
Yes. In fact, it's a real, very comforting thing. And I am able to kind of lose that, you know, kind of deep-seated fear factor in my life. I feel like I could walk out of any jungle, any desert, just about anywhere, and find something. Now, that is definitely not speaking to the fact that most of my harvesting, I'm timing with plants when they're in all their glory and there's an abundance of them. But, yeah, this food foraging thing definitely provides some, you know, kind of food security. And I feel like everywhere I go, I'll be able to, you know, marvel at the incredible gift of the plant nation and find something that is there and edible to eat.
Yes, that is a wonderful thing. And you were telling me earlier that your focus isn't really on sort of creating the mentality of being sort of like a survivalist kind of thing, which is perfectly fine, but that your focus is really on enhancing our current diet with beautiful, nutritious plants. It's not a complete departure from our regular habits. It's really an enhancement and a deepening in a relationship with our food and our nutrition.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's definitely this buzz about, you know, survival. Let's throw people out in the woods first and see what happens. But no, my message has always been this kind of this one wild food every day. Let's actually incorporate these foods into our day to day. And so doing that realistically is this message of one wild food every day, where you're just eating a small, you're supplementing your diet. And so I grow a lot of foods, and I really abide by the whole permaculture philosophy and grow a lot of perennial greens and fruit trees. But there are these wild plants that move through my permaculture-inspired forest, and I eat them. And they are all around us, and they're free, and they're nutritious. And so this idea of just, you know, you can't go to the store and buy these wild foods. So when you go out and you get into nature, you are having an experience. There are smells that are happening. There are sounds. There are things you're seeing, the way things feel. And all of this becomes a very rich gift of wild foods, where, again, you know, you have this kind of story of connection that you've made with your bioregion, you know, this area from where you live. And so to me, it just really speaks of this very deep, this very deep thing. And again, the nutritional quality is so outstanding that even eating a small amount really does make a difference. Mm.
I think more people are aware of the fact now that a lot of the food we find in the supermarket has been selected for so many years now for its shipability, its longevity in, you know, cold storage. And we've lost mm-hmm. so much of the inherent nutrition of the foods as they originated on the earth, and going back to these wild foods, we'll find some of the most nutrient dense examples of the plant world.
Yeah, and that's certainly exaggerated when, you know, estimates put it somewhere around 85% of our food is shipped, you know, over 3,000 miles to get here to the Hawaiian Islands. So, mm-hmm. yeah. We're looking at really fresh food that's in season, you know, that you're typically just going out into your own backyard or your favorite hike, or, you know, maybe you have an auntie who has a property and you're like, oh my gosh, auntie, look at you have all of this fantastic food. Do you mind if I take some? Do you mind if I harvest some for you? So it's definitely a more community-oriented way of eating. I mean, it's a personal experience of, you know, you're the one who's eating one wild food every day. But when we're looking at people really getting out there and foraging, you know, it always brings up land rights and access.
Sure.
And so it really encourages us to reach out to our neighbors and befriend them and say, hey.
And invite them to have a different relationship with the plants. And I was hoping we could look at a couple of examples, a little preview of what kind of relationship people might be able to foster. And we talked about maybe a couple example plants that you could talk about that people might be likely to see on some of your hikes.
Yeah. Well, when I have been to Kauai before, I have noticed that there are a large number of Java plums on the island, as well as a large number of them on all of the islands. Maybe not Lanai that I'm sitting out and looking across at, but the Java plum is a fantastic, you know, plant tree that is widely available. It can get fairly tall, so finding these little tricks of maybe somewhere where it grows on a hillside and you can reach out and grab the dark purplish to black colored fruits easily. They are exceptionally nutritious. I mean, you're getting to eat purple. I always get excited about eating purple. It's got to be good for you, right?
And wearing it, too, inevitably.
Yes.
with the juice from the Java plum.
Yes, they definitely have that staining quality to them, as you can see in pavements, you know, where the fruit falls to the ground and splatters. But yeah, very few people are actually taking that initiative to eat them, and they're widely available, and they are an astringent fruit. So astringent is something where you would eat it and it would kind of have a drying effect on your mouth. But that quality can be masked with, you know, I like to make a lot of chutney out of my Java plum. I find that to be a really fun use where virtually all of the astringency goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And the other plant that we had, I was hoping to mention was the honohono grass. And that one is usually a jaw dropper for people that are like, what, you can eat that?
Isn't it eating my yard? Who's eating who here? This is one of our more challenging weeds in the garden, the farm, and people really do have a love-hate relationship with it. It has medicinal qualities, but the edible quality, I would say, is even less known, and I'm excited to hear from you about it.
Yeah, I'll eat the last few inches of the plant, anything that looks, you know, clean, vibrant, healthy. If it's had, you know, a lot of moisture lately, it's usually looking a little bit more succulent. So I'll harvest that, the last few inches of the plant. Maybe the very last emerging leaf I'll eat raw, but the rest of it I cook. And it typically does well with kind of a longer, moist heat. So you've got to think, maybe I'm making a stew, or if I'm doing a saute or stir fry, I would think of it along the lines of a carrot, where I put my carrots in a little bit early and maybe add some moisture, some broth, or some shoyu, or something of the like, where it's applying that, and then I cover it, and I let it kind of steam in there for a while. So the honohono does well with a nice, moist heat, and it can really be added into anything. Just visualize what you had for breakfast, or visualize what you were thinking of having for dinner. You know, can you add a cooked green to that? These are very mild in flavor. There was a really fun publication that was put out by the Windward Community College over on Oahu. And whenever we're looking at kind of figuring out information about plants, it's really good to go to our ethnobotanical information first. So these folks there went and kind of scoured the ethnobotanical info and saw people were, you know, using the plant in Southeast Asia, and they were using the plant in India, and then they went to peer-reviewed journals and what other scientists were looking at with the plant, and did a nice, you know, review of the literature that way, and then they got to experimenting.
And they validated, you know, through this, you know, empirical data that the plant is edible, and they came up with several recipes. There's lots of recipes in their publication, but that it also is a fantastic medicinal that can be used. It can be juiced and gargled for strep in the treatment of, you know, like a strep throat. And the plant can be dried and powdered and used as a very effective blood coagulant. So you're in the kitchen and you cut yourself with a knife, or you're out hiking and you fall and scrape your knee. But, you know, when you have that, the blood is you're like, oh, I got to stop this. So you can use a fresh poultice, but that did not prove as effective as the dried and powdered plant. So, you know, again, we're just kind of having this understanding that there are all of these fantastic plants, and really they all have some kind of use, whether it even just at this moment in time be providing us with some oxygen on the planet as we're not tending to a lot of the land and letting things go. So these, both the Java plum and the honeyhorn grass, are invasives. I mean, they are truly invasive plants. And so they are there, and they are able to provide us with this incredible, not only food source, but medicine as well. And the Java plum has been studied extensively in the treatment of diabetes. It's also shown to have cardioprotective effects against pesticide exposure. So, wow, wouldn't it be cool to start selling, you know, Java plum chutney over in Waimea or something. You know, I just thinking of all these fabulous opportunities.
So many business opportunities with these wild plants, for sure. And here in the Hawaiian Islands, so many of the wild plants we have access to are not native, are not at risk of, you know, population decline if we do some harvesting. And what a great opportunity people are going to have to walk with you and learn about more of these plants this weekend. And so, want to let people know, Sunny Savage, we're speaking with here, and she has a new book, The Wild Food Plants of Hawaii. And before we say goodbye to you, I want to know a little bit about, this is your latest evolution in terms of providing information. Tell us a little bit about the book. It's a beautiful thing. I've seen it on the internet, at least.
Thank you. Yeah, the book was going to be many different things, and so finally simple and beautiful was what won out. And so there are lots of incredible photographs throughout the book that make it really easy and approachable for the novice to the experience. I would say that as someone with multiple degrees in nutrition, my emphasis has been a lot on, once you have learned to identify a plant, what in the world are you going to do with it? And so I'm really filling that gap of what to do with it, and in, you know, teasing into the imagination different ways that you can bring these wild plants into your daily diet. So there are recipes, there are lots of just kind of these teasers of ideas of things that you can do with these plants. And it also includes a nice little resource section. I've got, I think, 60 journal articles that are, I think none of them are more than 5 years old. I basically kind of just did a current review on research related to the plants that I was talking about. And it covers over 40 wild foods, and I think the real gift is that you get the Latin or the scientific name, so you can punch that in and do an online internet search and have 10,000 images of the plant that comes up. So it's a nice, easily approachable book.
Awesome. Fantastic. So your dates again, correct me if I'm wrong, November 20th, that's this Friday.
Correct.
You're going to be at Lydgate State Park with a wild food hike from 1 to 3 p.m.
Yep.
You're going to be in Hanapepe later that evening at the Talk Story Bookstore from 5 to 9.
Yeah.
Then on Saturday, you'll be at the Ininaho Namahana Farmers Market on the North Shore from 9 to noon with your book. And I'm pretty sure that Kilauea workshop in the afternoon is sold out. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. That one is full, but we definitely got room for whoever wants to join us at Kokei State Park on Monday, the 23rd. And we'll be cruising around up in the forest up there and being respectful of the Aina and learning ways of harvesting in a pono way. And so, yeah.
Wonderful, Sunny. And then for our Oahu listeners, you're also finishing up your book tour on Oahu as well.
I am. I had all of my dates written down, and that ended up blowing away. But I will be on Oahu right after Thanksgiving, and I'll be doing a wild food hike at Kapiolani State Park, kind of at the base of Diamond Head. I'll be doing a wild food hike at UH Manoa with a dear friend, foraging friend Matt Bletter of Madre Chocolate, in partnership with Slow Food Oahu. And I'll be doing two seated meals at the Kaimuki Superette. Chef Ed Kenny of, you know, town. He has three different Mud Hen Water Town and Kaimuki Superette. So he's going to be the head chef for two wild food themed sit down meals at Kaimuki Superette.
Wow. Food is so fun. Thank you for making it fun with us.
Yay! Well, I appreciate the aloha.
So
thanks
for people who want more information, you've got a great website, Sunny Savage, SunnySavage.com. And if people in the near term want to get in touch with you, is there any other contact info you'd like to share?
Sure. People can feel free to call me at 808-866-8294. I also have a website, wildfoodplants.com, and I have a newsletter sign up on that site that you can kind of stay up to date with future events as well. And so, yeah, 808-866-8294 or sunnysavage@gmail.com.
Fantastic. Thank you, Sunny. Looking forward to seeing you this weekend.
All righty. Thank you, Paul. Aloha.
That was Sunny Savage with the Wild Food book coming out, Wild Food Plants of Hawaii. It is out, and she'll be here on Kauai this weekend sharing all of that great perspective with us and knowledge. And we're looking forward to a call from Paul Taylor coming up soon. He's got a biochar workshop coming up. We're happy to be presenting with him at the Kauai Food Forest this Sunday, November 22nd, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And so we're waiting for his call. I'll start out by just giving you a little bit on that. He's going to be giving us the history of biochar and the present and as well demonstrations. So fantastic. I want to introduce our next guest, and I want to thank Dove, who's answering phones for us right now, doing a super job. Our next guest on the show is Paul Taylor. Paul graduated with the University Medal in Physics from the University of New South Wales, Australia. He received his PhD from the University of Colorado. He's worked at Harvard Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the editor and lead contributor of the book, The Biochar Revolution, Transforming Agriculture and Environment. He's a global presenter on the subject and developer of the Contiki Biochar Kiln. Paul lives in Australia and the U.S., where he researches and presents on biochar and climate change, and he's going to be here this weekend to teach a biochar workshop. Paul.
Hello, Paul.
How are you?
Very well.
Excellent. And we are speaking with you as well from the island of Maui, as our last guest was.
Yes, that's correct.
Great. And so you're here in the state of Hawaii, or the kingdom of Hawaii, over the next few weeks, building biochar kilns, doing educational workshops, and we're super grateful to have you, because, boy, do we need some soil remediation here in the Hawaiian Islands.
Great. Well, I'm glad to be here.
Fantastic. So I would be very interested to hear about how an astrophysicist changes course and decides that biochar is the life mission.
Yeah, well, you know, from my experience in astrophysics, particularly when I first went to the States and worked in Boulder, Colorado, I worked next to the Atmospheric Center for Atmospheric Research, National Center. And so I got real conditioned to the issue of climate change back in the 70s, and that we really didn't want a 1 degree rise in temperature, which we have now. We've just crossed that point. So I was always concerned about the environment, and when I started going back to Australia, my home country, I got invited to do a bunch of roadshows for climate change to introduce Al Gore, and I quickly realized that we're going to have to manage our landscape. We really had to manage all that carbon that was in the ground, and then I saw the BBC documentary, Treasures of Sierra Madre, Treasures of the El Dorado, and really got tuned into how biochar could help with that. And then I made it a mission pretty soon to try to develop farm-scale biochar equipment and to present on the subject.
Well, that all makes a lot of sense now. So that's a very logical progression. And biochar is something that we've known about for some years here in Hawaii. People got really excited about it on the forefront, as it was going to be the sort of that latest silver bullet that was going to solve all of our agricultural ills. And then we started to hear reports that, oh, maybe it's not all it's cracked up to be. And so we've heard some of this conflicting stuff, but I know that from speaking with you and from reading, it's really not just about the charcoal itself, but it's about what you do to the charcoal after you've created it that is important as well.
That's right. It's putting the bio in the char. And we know it works because, you know, the Amazon civilization did it. That's what the documentary was about. They had a civilization there which should not have been able to occur in the Amazon jungle. You can't do that with nomadic agriculture and slash and burn. And we also saw that they left very rich soils. And once those soils are analyzed and carbon dated, they're up to 3,500 years old, and they have charcoal in them. They're a midden soil. And these people did something that we don't know how to do, which is to farm soil for thousands of years and actually grow the soil. So they ended up with, you know, 6-foot deep pockets of this soil all over the Amazon. So we know it works. The question is now to track down what it is. And at first, of course, scientists just wanted to put charcoal, called now biochar since 2007 by a climate scientist in New Zealand, put that in the soil at maybe 10 tons or 20 tons per hectare. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Certainly puts the carbon away from the atmosphere, but we want the agronomic benefit. And we've had to learn some of the tricks. And the trick is to put the bio in the char by charging it with the nutrients so it's not seeking to get them from the soil and competing with the plant.
Right. So if you just put in straight biochar right out of the kiln, it's going to act like a sponge and just sequester the nutrients away
from
the plants.
A lot of the properties of biochar have to do with the properties of charcoal. And everybody knows that charcoal is a great filter, and you can take it when you're sick to heal your tummy up and so on, and get rid of toxins. So it's a great filter, a great absorber, and if you put it in the soil, sometimes it'll help and sometimes it won't. It depends on the soil and the climate and so on. So the trick is to add the nutrients that the soil needs. And actually, sometimes you don't need very much charcoal or biochar. If you've conditioned it properly, a very small amount will do the job, which is good news for the farmer because now you get the agronomic benefit with much less biochar. And more is not better. You've got to have a balance of the biochar with the nutrients.
And more is not better is a maxim that would be applied to fertilizer as well. There's a certain point of no return where the fertilizer is either burning, damaging the plant, or it's just leaching below the root zone, and it's lost, and it's in the water table.
Well, exactly. This
so is not a new
part of that. The farmers faced with the predicament of getting enough nutrients in before he plants the plant, and that they will be there when the plant needs it over its growing cycle, and they're leaching away. So typically, maybe three times more nutrients are added than needed, and sometimes so much that it does burn the plant. Biochar solves both of those problems. It acts as a slow-release fertilizer. It holds the nutrients in place in the root zone where you put the biochar, and it has this property called cation exchange capacity, which is the capacity to absorb nutrient ions, you know, like calcium and phosphorus and so on, and release them when the plant demands them. So that way the plant doesn't get burned anymore. You can have a lot of fertilizer or a lot of nutrients in the biochar, and they won't hurt the plant, but they'll be there long term for the plant.
So we've heard that biochar has a liming effect, meaning it's raising the pH to some extent of the soil.
Yes, so correct. That's one of its modes of operation. Mm-hmm. Biochar works. There's been a lot of studies done and meta studies, and generally you can say that biochar, you know, taking it all into account, improves the soil, and it improves acidic soils best, in tropical soils and acidic soils. And poor soils, and one of the ways it's doing that is from the liming effect. Biochar is alkaline typically, particularly if you make it from wood. It's a little bit less if you make it from chicken manure and so on. So it adjusts the pH of the soil, and that's one of the things it does. Of course, that means you don't want to put a alkaline biochar into an alkaline soil, and in that case you would then condition the biochar to make it more acidic, possibly with organic acid like citric acid or vinegar or phosphoric acid, which brings phosphorus in as well. So you adjust the pH of the biochar to the soil.
Wow, fascinating. And you were telling me before that the best biochar is made from manures?
Well, look, there's lots of caveats to everything, but generally there's lots of different feedstocks. Remember that biochar, unlike charcoal, can be made from any organic material. So lots of things are used, and it wants to be a sustainably harvested material, like crop residues and so on. And because of the way biochar has been used up until, you know, as we've gradually learned, sometimes it hasn't received a benefit, sometimes it has. But the one combination that's nearly always worked is biochar that's made from wheat straw or grasses, and biochar that's made from manures or combinations thereof. So that just means that those materials, when they're pyrolyzed and or carbonized and made into biochar, have the nutrients already installed in them. Mm-hmm. And if you make a biochar from a woody biomass, then you don't take that straight to the soil, but you make sure that you charge the biochar with nutrients.
I want to let listeners know we're speaking with Paul Taylor. He is a biochar specialist. He's coming to Kauai this weekend and teaching a workshop at the Kauai Food Forest Sunday, November 22nd from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And if people are interested in registering for the workshop, they can go to our website, ribg.org, or if you did an internet search for Biochar Revolution Workshop, you'll get the information there as well. What could people expect to come away learning and seeing at the workshop, Paul?
Well, that's where we have a lot more time to go into things. So really, what I like to do is cover what biochar is, why we think it works, why we think it's safe, the multiple benefits of biochar. Biochar is something that you might think, well, if it's all so good, what about side effects? But it really does seem to have side benefits. It solves multiple problems at once. And I'm particularly interested that people, you know, find that they can do this themselves. We don't have to wait for this to become an industry, which it could do in Hawaii, because it would be a great way to generate electricity and use the biomass. But we can do it on the farm and the backyard too. So we'll demonstrate that actual process of working with the fire to make the biochar. And it's quite intriguing for people. It's like a reinvention of fire, or how you manage it and use it so you get, you stop the process at the moment you want to, where you get the biochar, and lots of it.
Pretty exciting.
And then we'll also talk about how to blend it with compost and minerals and nutrients and so on.
Great, great. And we want to let listeners know that we do have restrictions on burning here, and I know some people have run into some problems with an intention of making biochar here, and there are state regulations based on the off-gassing, or basically the smoke produced by fires just in general. And so permits are required, and there is some complexity to it. But we have sought a educational permit for this weekend. But we're also going to let people know how they can apply with the Department of Health and what it takes to actually be on the right side of the law when it comes to making biochar. And I want to give thanks to the staff here on Kauai because there's an understanding now that biochar is a different kind of a fire. It has a different kind of byproducts that come out of it that make it much safer to burn than a standard fire. And even just from people learning about how to make biochar, perhaps will make better, safer agricultural fires in general that don't produce as much toxic off-gassing. So I'm excited that that's going to be part of the learning, and hopefully people will be more empowered to be able to generate biochar themselves from this process.
Yeah, Paul, that's a really good point. You know, in California, we've developed this conservation burn, and typically you do, you know, in Australia too, there's always crops being burned in the field. But if you light the fire in the right way, basically you make a pyre and light the fire from the top, then all the smoke that's released gets consumed in the fire. And, you know, there may be regular farm burns all around, and the ones that are burning with this technique, these conservation burn, are just clean. You wouldn't know they were there. And you're making biochar in the process.
Very cool. So I know that you are the author of at least one great book. I was grateful to receive a copy from you when I met you over there in California a few weeks ago on biochar, a really wonderful book with lots of contributors and a really detailed analysis of the various factors involved and the various uses of biochar. But I know that you're also in process of authoring a practical guide.
That's right. That's exactly right. One of my colleagues, Professor Stephen Joseph, is really at the forefront, and he's been particularly in the search of what these, what terra preta is. Terra preta is what we call the soils in Brazil, and it's more than just charcoal. It's these biochar mineral complexes. So we've learned a tremendous amount about that, and those techniques have been used in field trials. They're working. You can use much less biochar, and they can be made at home on the farm, you know, using the local, everything local on the farm, like the clays and things like that. So the book is a practical guide. It'd be like a permaculture manual. It'll have lots of case studies. We're producing that in 2016. And we hope also out of that will come trainers that can teach and present on biochar and eventually train people to teach and present.
Wow. Well, I really commend you on your work. I'm very excited to learn more when you come over this weekend, and I'm excited that you had the opportunity to introduce people to more information at the statewide Hawaii Farmers Union Conference just this past weekend. How was that?
Oh, no, that's coming, actually. That's on the, when I come back from Kauai on the,
oh, okay,
on the 24th. And then on the 29th, we have a workshop at Haleakua Garden Farm, similar to the one in Kauai for anybody on Maui that can hear this and visit. And then we also have one on the Big Island on December the 5th at Josiah Hunt's farm.
Wonderful.
Near Hilo.
Great. Much thanks to Josiah, who's been providing us biochar for several years now here on Kauai.
Yes, I really look forward to working with Josiah. He's got he uses these pits in the ground, which are kind of another version of our Kontiki kiln. Yeah. So we'll be bouncing up each other over there on the Big Island.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Paul. And we'll look forward to seeing you this Sunday for an in-depth look and investigation and hands-on experience with biochar.
Thank you very much, Paul. I look forward to it.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Aloha. So, this is the time of the show where I'm able to share some announcements coming up. You've heard about a couple great events happening this weekend, but there's more yet. And we'll start off with mentioning the Roots of Ulu showing during the Hawaii International Film Festival. This is a new film called The Roots of Ulu. I've heard it's really great. It's an inspiring documentary about breadfruit, starring our own Dr. Diane Ragone, the director of the Breadfruit Institute at NTBG. It's going to be held on various places around the Hawaiian Islands Wednesday, November 18th, this evening at the Dole Cannery on Oahu. Saturday, November 21st, the film will come here to the Waimea Theater on Kauai. And then Sunday, November 22nd, Hilo Palace Theater on Hawaii Island. So the Roots of Ulu. And that will be a tasty visual treat for sure. This Thursday, the Kauai Landscape Industry Council is holding their monthly meeting. This is 4 p.m. and it's being held at the Niamalu Pavilion at Niamalu Beach Park, which is near the Niwiliwili Small Boat Harbor. Topics will include a discussion of the Heipono Endorsement Program and a review of the very successful 2015 Arbor Day plant giveaway. So great that those guys do that. They give away over 1,000 plants on Arbor Day, native species and beloved cultural plants. If you want more information, you can get in touch by emailing click, K-L-I-C, on kauai at gmail.com. The Aloha Aina and Na'i Aupuni Process Community Meeting is happening this Friday, November 20th at 6 p.m. at the Wilcox Elementary School. Speakers including Uncle Walter Riddy and Trisha Kehalani Watson. And this is a community discussion about the Hawaiian sovereignty process, which is at a pretty big fork in the road right now. And this is a really important process for people interested in agriculture, as agriculture is one of those cornerstones of sovereignty and has been held as such in the Hawaiian community and culture since the beginning. If you want more information about this meeting, you can contact Auntie Puanani Rogers at 652-1249. Then there is a worm composting for schools mini grant program in the month of November. Malama Kauai is releasing a competitive mini grant for schools who are interested in running a worm composting program at their school in partnership with Connect 5 Kids. These programs help to build sustainability within school gardens by providing free fertilizer from the worms, as well as reduce campus waste by recycling food and paper waste. Sounds like a good idea to me. The deadline for this mini-grant program, the applications are due on November 30th. And if you want more information, you can call Megan at 828-0685, extension 12. And we've got some great activities happening at the Kauai Food Forest. We're doing a push through November and December to finish up our management of our tall nitrogen-fixing trees. And we really need skilled chainsaw operators, especially on the date of Wednesday, December the 2nd, so that we can bring the final portion of the food forest under long-term management with one powerful day. And we're preparing for a 3 years in celebration. The third year anniversary party for the food forest is coming up on December 13th, a Sunday, all day long. And we'll have a small seed exchange there and tours of the forest. We'll do memorial plantings. There'll be music and food and fun there. So put that on your calendar if you please. And for more information from our guests, we heard from Paul Taylor. You can visit his website, thebiocharrevolution.com, and know that his biochar workshop this Sunday, November 22nd, and tickets are available at ribg.org. We also spent some time today with Sunny Savage. She'll be here over the weekend doing several book signings, and more information at her website, sunnysavage.com, and you can also give her a call, too, at 866-8294. So this has been In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in and staying tuned for Kauai Vibrations with Tracy from 1 to 3 and all the fine programming following that. And I'm super grateful that all of you beautiful farmers, gardeners, and enthusiasts of plants and the natural environment are out there making a difference on Kauai. So much love to you, and invite you to tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.